Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. One-third of Americans are obese, and two-thirds of us are overweight. Couple that with the fact that some 20% of us experience a mental illness over the course of our lifetime, and that nearly half of Americans have symptoms of common afflictions like anxiety or depression, and it's not hard to see that there's tremendous overlap between both our nutrition and our mental health. My guest today sits at the nexus of both of those worlds. She's a board-certified psychiatrist and a trained chef. Dr. Uma Naidu is the director of nutritional and metabolic psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital. Her new book is titled, This Is Your Brain on Food. In the book, Naidu takes us through general principles such as how our brains and digestive systems come from similar embryonic developmental origins, and then reviews the relevant research in a series of chapters on conditions like depression, anxiety, obsessive-compulsive disorder, attention deficit disorder, and even how nutrition affects our memory. As a trained chef, she offers dozens of recipes that optimize healthful ingredients and cautions against processed foods and chemicals that can worsen our afflictions. Dr. Uma Naidu, nutritional psychiatrist and author of This Is Your Brain on Food, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Uma Naidu, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start just by having you share with us just some of the connections between our minds and our gut. It's well known that there are many connections at a cellular level, and many of the molecules, and I guess you could even say the archaic term humors in our body show the connection. But your book goes into some detail on this. I guess at a general level, how are our minds and our digestive systems connected?
Thanks so much for having me, Dr. Schumann, and I'm excited to share that with you. You know, the gut-brain connection actually explains the food-mood connection, which is what my book is about in nutritional psychiatry. And, you know, much of the cutting-edge research in the gut microbiome and that gut-brain axis actually tells us that and reminds us that gut and brain actually originate from the same exact cells in the embryo, and then they move apart in the body to form the gut and the brain. And then they remain connected throughout life by the 10th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve, which I like to call a two-way superhighway because it really conveys what the vagus nerve does in this context. It allows for chemical messages to be transported back and forth in both directions between the brain and gut and the gut and brain. And this actually explains how as food gets digested and is broken down into different particles and molecules, that it then has an impact on the chemical messaging system, which then feeds back to the brain. So I like to say to people, on the day that you're eating healthier foods, good byproducts of digestion are formed. And on the day that you're in the fast food drive-through lane, not so good byproducts of our digestion are formed. And that's one way to think about it.
Furthermore, those connections between gut and brain, perhaps at a most elemental level, you know, you write about, and others, of course, talk about the feeling of, say, butterflies in our stomach. There's really something to that. I mean, it's not just a feeling.
Yeah.
I mean, we know about some of the chemistry of that, and it's because of those neuroendocrine cells that are all across our gut, you know, from our stomach through our intestinal system, and really across our body. So there's really quite a connection.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that's when those terms such as butterflies in your stomach or, you know, the feeling of, you know, a feeling of sort of a little bit of nausea if a memory comes back to you or you drive past an area, say, that is related to a negative memory in your life, maybe a breakup or a bad argument you had with someone, or maybe you had a difficult experience in school. You know, those are actually all related to our emotions. And it turns out that those gut microbes, of which there are about 39 trillion living in the gut microbiome, you know, they actually really translate into a lot of our emotional health as well.
Now, the name of your book, This Is Your Brain on Food, which, by the way, that is a fantastic title because I think it, you know, I think for some of us, it references this, I guess, 1980s public service announcement about, like, this is your brain on drugs kind of thing. But food is a drug. Food is a medicine. And so how we eat and what we choose to eat absolutely affects our brains and our moods. And I think where your book is really special and takes it kind of a level beyond is not just, hey, I recommend that you eat healthily because you'll feel better. But you get very specific. And because you're a board-certified psychiatrist, you know, you're taking on various specific mental health topics and going into some of the science, but at a, you know, very lay reader level. So, for example, you have a chapter on depression, a chapter on anxiety, even a chapter on PTSD and ADHD. But I guess we obviously don't have time to go into all of those, but I guess, what are some of the broad brushstrokes you could suggest for, I guess, depression and anxiety being the most common, they kind of lead off the book. What are some general principles that you could advise our listeners on, you know, foods to avoid or foods that you would recommend for optimal mood or optimal, you know, brain health?
Absolutely. So I'd like to run through very quickly the list of foods to limit or cut back on or have awareness that actually impact our mental health. Because as I list in every chapter of the book, there are many more foods to embrace than there are foods to avoid. But I think what is critical about the list of foods to sort of limit is that many people associate these foods with, you know, maybe onset of type 2 diabetes or poor metabolic health or weight gain. What we don't realize is that the conversation that we're not having with our doctors is really how food impacts our mental health, because there are foods such as, you know, ultra-processed, processed sort of junk foods and fast foods, which actually impact mental health, not only because of the additives, preservatives, processed vegetable oils and other things, but also the added sugars. And then there are the added refined sugars in our foods. You know, there are upwards of 200 other names for sugar on food labels these days. My favorite to quote is brown rice syrup. People get mistaken because they hear that brown rice is a healthy alternative. But brown rice syrup is actually sugar. So people just having an awareness of food labels and knowing that they're consuming more added sugars without realizing the name is important. And then, you know, a lot of fast foods and a lot of restaurants, not every restaurant, but processed vegetable oils are less expensive, but they are pro-inflammatory. And they really create more inflammation in our body, but most importantly in our gut, which then impacts our mental health, is another big category. And then artificial sweeteners, many of my patients might feel they want to cut back on the sugars or the soda that they're drinking. But when they move to a diet soda or a sugar-free item, it actually might have artificial sweeteners that drive mental health symptoms. And those are the very large sort of broad categories. But then the foods that you want to start embracing, start with what I call the six, some of the pillars of nutritional psychiatry. They start off with simple things like, you know, eat the orange, skip the store-bought orange juice, because the orange has the fiber, the minerals, the vitamins, all of the phytochemicals that you need. But the store-bought orange juice has a fiber stripped with a ton of added sugar. And the principle here is that the fiber and all of those nutrients really nurture those gut microbes, because in order for them to thrive, survive, and help us, especially with our mental health, as well as everything else, they need to be fed. And fiber is one way to take care of them. Another category is eat the colors, the rainbow. And the many colors of phytochemicals in plant foods and fruit actually help our gut microbes again. Not only are they antioxidant-rich, anti-inflammatory-rich, but they also are rich in fiber. And, you know, it's an important base of how we should be eating, a sort of a diet that's rich in lots of plants and having enough servings of fruit. A study showed that, you know, only 1 in 10 Americans is eating enough vegetables or fruit servings. And I think it's helpful for us to understand this is something we can very easily up our game just by, say, increasing the size of vegetables you have with your protein, or having a large, healthy salad for lunch or one of your meals. Another one is the greener, the better. And here it's really pointing out that, you know, the leafy greens that your doctors may ask you to eat actually have quite a punch when it comes to mental well-being, because leafy greens, the greener the better, are rich in folate. And folate is a key nutrient in mental health, because low folate levels are associated with depression and other things. So just having an adequate supply of those greens in your diet, whether you steam them, whether you have them in a salad, is just super important. And then, you know, I go into a discussion of some other basic things, such as probiotic and prebiotic foods, fermented foods, omega-3 rich foods, healthy fats. All of these are really great building blocks to how you can improve your mental fitness. But then another secret is the spices in your spice cabinet, because many of those actually also pack a punch in terms of improving symptoms of your mood, as well as reducing stress and anxiety.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Uma Naidu, who is a triple threat. She is a psychiatrist, a trained chef, and a nutrition expert. She's also the author of the book, This Is Your Brain on Food, an indispensable guide to the surprising foods that fight many psychiatric conditions, including common ones like depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, ADHD. Dr. Naidu is also the director of the Nutritional and Metabolic Psychiatry Program at Massachusetts General Hospital. And we're talking about various foods that can have both detrimental and positive effects on our moods, our mental health. And, you know, one of the things you have just pointed out is that sugar comes in so many different forms. And I think you gave a great example, brown rice syrup. Now, here's something that has a name that sounds, hey, brown rice. I know I'm supposed to eat brown rice instead of white rice, and yet it's basically like eating sugar, maple syrup in a way, almost. And sweeteners, artificial sweeteners. So people say, well, I'm drinking diet soda, so I'm not getting all of that sugar. But in fact, you're saying chemically that artificial sweeteners, and there's really no exception to this, whether it's Splenda or the other ones, they do not have a beneficial effect on our minds. And then, of course, we often are encouraged to eat vegetable oils, but you're saying that the cheaper oils don't have that beneficial effect. So you're suggesting there are healthy fats. And let's talk a little bit about omega-3s or omega-6 fats. You know, our brain is, I think you write, 60% of our brain is composed of fat. So it's important that we have healthy fats to sort of maintain our brain health. Give us some examples of healthy fats.
Absolutely. So, you know, healthy fats are the monounsaturated fats like olive oil, the nuts that actually have healthy fats in them, nut butters, avocados, and then things like, you know, you can also get omega-3 fatty acids from fatty fish like sockeye salmon, sardines, anchovies, but you get plant-based sources of the short-chain omega-3s in walnuts, hemp seeds, flax seeds, sea vegetables, and others. So there are ways to actually incorporate these. And you're absolutely right. It's about getting fats from the right place for our brain health. And these are just some easy examples of things that you can start to incorporate in your meals.
Okay. So one of the myths that you tackle, there's this urban legend that goes around every year at Thanksgiving about tryptophan in turkey. That's why we get soporific. That is to say, we get really sleepy after our Thanksgiving meal. And I want to point out that it is perfectly permissible not to eat turkey, not to indulge in meat. But that's, most of us do still like to do that, although many don't. But it's really not so much the tryptophan as it is the overeating and the overindulging and eating a lot of sweets. But in fact, tryptophan is an amino acid that has some really beneficial effects. So you kind of burst this myth. Tell us about tryptophan.
Absolutely. So, you know, it turns out that tryptophan is, it's a building block for serotonin. And it actually has to enter the brain. So it turns out that, you know, the reason that tryptophan might be entering our brain on Thanksgiving is because of things like mashed potatoes that we might be having. And that may actually lead to that sort of slightly calming or slightly pleasant, happy, maybe slightly sleepy feeling. But, you know, it's an important building block. And it is, in fact, serotonin that helps us. You know, people call serotonin a happiness hormone. And I think that what I really learned that, you know, the foods that are high in simple carbs, such as those side dishes that we may be indulging in and enjoying at Thanksgiving, that help that transportation of tryptophan to enter the brain where it is converted to serotonin. And so that immediate feeling is actually a nice feeling. But, you know, I think what I also learned is that in the long term, over the course of our lives, we don't always want to be eating that way because that high level of simple carbohydrates in our diet also make sure that insulin is released a lot to take care of that sugar load. And ultimately, that is not good for us because the high blood sugar levels over time are really not the best for our mental health in the end. So, you know, there are great sources of tryptophan. There are sources such as chickpeas. That you can indulge in as well. And I think it's the pairing up with the carbohydrates that is something I learned more about.
Okay, now, I alluded earlier to how the chapters of your book are divided sort of by psychiatric condition, but there are definitely themes that emerge across all of these conditions. And I would say it seems to me that you're pretty much a proponent of the Mediterranean diet. It seems as though... And that's something I think many listeners are familiar with, the Mediterranean diet. I guess share with us what you find advantageous in the Mediterranean diet and if there are any aspects of it that you don't necessarily recommend.
You know, I like the Mediterranean diet. It does have a significant amount of evidence in nutritional psychiatry for improvement of mood and anxiety. I also happen to think that it is rich in vegetables. It is rich in plant foods, nuts, seeds, olive oil, healthy fats, like olive oil as well as avocado, legumes, which are great and rich in fibers, such as chickpeas and others, and proteins as well. So it includes seafood and includes poultry. It depends on what your particular diet is. I feel that, you know, where things are at for me in nutritional psychiatry is that I consider myself diet agnostic. So I really have to be open to helping a patient, and they come in with a diet that's carnivore or vegan, whichever extreme or in between it might be. My role is really to help tweak that to the best possible value that they might have to improve their mental fitness depending on their symptoms. The Mediterranean diet, I do think, covers a lot of good principles in good nutrition. And it can't be argued that, you know, eating enough vegetables and having that level of fiber in your diet is bad for you. Unless, of course, the caveat being that if you have IBS or Crohn's disease or problems in digesting and breaking down fiber, that can be uncomfortable for you. But fiber is something you can only obtain from vegetables, fruit, beans, nuts, seeds, legumes, and healthy whole grains. You can't get it from animal and seafood protein. So the reason I focus on fiber is, again, nurturing those gut microbes. And that tends to be what they need. You know, I like to say a happy gut is a happy mood, because when you take care of those gut microbes, they actually can function. And they can break down, they can help break down food into a positive product called short-chain fatty acids, which is one of the ways that helps us improve our mood, help our anxiety, and many other conditions.
So you anticipated actually another question of mine, which was, you have patients that come to you, as you said, on a spectrum ranging from carnivore, that is people who eat meat, all the way to vegan, people who avoid all animal products. And so I guess I just was hoping you could clarify, is you're not advocating a specific type of diet or whether or not people should be vegan, but do you lean one way or another? In other words, would you counsel someone who is a heavy meat eater and not getting enough fiber to steer more toward vegandom? Or would you just say, you know, eat more vegetables, eat more of the leafy greens, that kind of thing?
For me, it's really about, I don't favor one over the other. But what I do talk about are these sort of pillars of nutritional psychiatry, which I hope many people can start to include. And the reason is that, you know, the evidence in nutritional science and nutritional epidemiology is ever changing. What I have found consistently with my patients, and what I have discovered through looking at the gut-brain research and the gut microbiome research, is that the more we take care of the gut microbiome, the better our mental health might be. So if someone is, say, consuming a vegan diet, they might or might not need vitamin B12. Many vegans will argue that they don't need it, but I do think it's based on, you know, test, don't guess. So one should have, if one has eaten a vegan diet for a while, no one's saying you're not healthy, but just get your vitamin B12 level checked, because, yes, you can have different supplements for that, but you want to make sure it's covered. On the other hand, someone who's eating a carnivore diet may not be getting the needed fiber, as I mentioned, that is from plant foods and beans, nuts, seeds, legumes, and fruit. They may not be consuming enough of those. So it's about finding, you know, encouraging them towards maybe a better balance, or including foods that they can tolerate, especially if they're having certain symptoms in mental health, because including those foods can actually create a little bit more of a balance for them. You know, there are many studies that are proponents of eating more plants or eating more plant-based foods or vegetables and fruit to improve mental health. But there are also studies that show that meat eating improves mental health. So it's really about almost interpreting the scientific evidence for individuals based on what they're eating, rather than taking, rather than polarizing to one extreme or the other.
I want to pick on a couple of specifics here in the book. One is that in the chapter on OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, you mention a condition that I think is worth educating listeners about, something called orthorexia. Can you tell us what that is?
Orthorexia is... The best way to explain it is, you know, becoming careful and wanting to eat healthy, but becoming careful to the point that it's almost on the edge of obsessional. And so someone who's trying to consume a healthy diet starts to either exclude certain foods because they want to be so extremely healthy. And what I find is that behavior at times can almost become a little bit obsessive, and they very much a controlled type of eating behavior, which is really not that dissimilar from eating disorders, where someone is either, say, restricting food, or on the other extreme, binging on certain foods and then sometimes purging on those foods. So I think that what has been challenging with individuals with orthorexia is they really are trying to be healthy, But some of it is understanding the psychology behind it, some of the fears that are driving them to engage in certain eating behaviors or restrictive behaviors. Because I think that what I find people struggle with the most in the United States are the polarizing sort of diet wars that go on, eat this, don't eat that, exclude this food, you know, between the media, but also informing people, but then people reading different books or different journals and trying to find information, they tend to get a little confused about what they should be eating. And I think that with orthorexia, it's individuals who really take that to the extreme and sometimes actually develop even nutrient deficiencies or start to only eat such a restricted diet that is really not healthy for them ultimately and certainly not good for their mental health.
Okay, very interesting. Yeah. Now, there's another chapter that I thought was probably the most fun. I mean, some of these aren't fun in the sense of talking about debilitating psychiatric illnesses, but of course, that's the section on libido or our sex drive. So what are some, there are definitely foods to avoid that will disenhance either our sex drive or performance. On the other hand, you suggest there are some foods that can enhance sex drive. Tell us, I guess, give us your kind of quick summary of that chapter.
Sure. You know, it's interesting because Valentine's Day is always associated with chocolate. But I just want to caution people that, you know, dark chocolate is actually the way to go because it is one of the foods that boosts oxytocin. And so dark chocolate is rich in magnesium, serotonin, and several other things. So it's, you know, foods that help oxytocin are important to include. And then it turns out that, you know, red wine, especially at least a glass a day, has been thought to be helpful in nuts, like pistachios, which was news to me and interesting to find in the research, was another one. Pomegranate juice, onions, avocados, and certain spices, saffron and fenugreek. Fenugreek is often used in North Indian and certain types of Indian cuisine and has a very interesting flavor. But, you know, it's just something to know about that you can start including in your diet. And avocados, I like to make a dark chocolate mousse. So you're combining that dark chocolate from this list and add avocado to it to make it creamy for a pretty good dessert instead of, you know, the regular way that chocolate mousse is made.
Yeah, and I've done that using avocado as basically the base for the cream with other recipes. I haven't tried yours, but I thank you for mentioning that because you have dozens of recipes in the book as well. So it's not only incredibly full of information and some of the latest science, but full of actually wonderful recipes from a Culinary Institute trained chef that you are, Dr. Uma Naidu. And so I thought that was quite interesting about these different foods that can enhance libido. There are a couple of foods that are chemicals that pop up repeatedly in almost all of these chapters and come in for some, you know, I would say there's some controversy about both of them. And I guess they raise to the level of being specified here. And those are caffeine and alcohol. And I guess in the libido chapter, it turns out that caffeine has, it's seemingly a beneficial effect. But there has been so much study of both caffeine and alcohol that I think some of the evidence is contradictory. But I guess if you had to summarize them both, what would you say in general about caffeine and alcohol? Is it just moderation or, you know, different times for different chemicals?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think that my stance on caffeine and alcohol is not that dissimilar from meat versus vegetables. I think that more people consume these than don't. And I would rather offer people guidelines around how to incorporate these. For example, you know, red wine, yes, a glass a day can potentially be healthy, and studies have shown that. Overall, overindulging in alcohol can be very bad for the body. On the other hand, caffeine and coffee has had some very positive evidence behind it. But it's not consuming too much for your body, for your body intelligence, as I call it. And also certain conditions can be worsened with caffeine intake from coffee. So anxiety, if someone has, you know, feels jittery after a cup of coffee in the morning, caffeine from coffee may not be for them, especially if they have anxiety. On the other hand, there are other benefits. So not only moderation, I think that with both coffee and alcohol, it's really also what people add to them. If you're adding a ton of processed creamer, a ton of artificial sweeteners or sugar, if you're having a mixed drink with several different liqueurs, fruit juice and simple syrup is simply sugar, one part sugar, one part water, you're actually adding on empty calories that make it worse. for your overall mental health. So some of the principle is moderation. The other is the cleaner, the better. And then thirdly, you know, trying to find what your body intelligence is. And if it's something you're not tolerating, you're noticing a difference, you're noticing yourself feel more anxious or uncomfortable or jittery, then that's your body telling you that you need to make an adjustment. And that's really how I view coffee and alcohol.
Well, thank you for that. I want to turn our attention just to your career, which is so interesting. And you really are at the nexus of psychiatry and nutrition. How did you wind up forging this career path? I mean, it's somewhat non-traditional. There probably aren't that many. I have talked to some other physician chefs, none that I know of who are also psychiatrists. So it's pretty spectacular, pretty special. How did you wind up going in this direction?
I'd love to say that I had this grand plan, but I really didn't. I was very blessed that my passions and my interests came together in a very meaningful way. It starts with my love for food and family, just the way that I grew up. I grew up, skipped out of preschool, spent the time with my maternal grandmother, to whom my book is dedicated. And my mom was at medical school. She was a double boarder physician. And so I would spend the daytime with my grandmother. I'd watch her cook. I would help her. We'd pick fresh vegetables from the garden. I'd hang out with my grandparents, who taught me yoga and meditation and cool things. But as I, you know, as I grew up, I really had a passion for food, but also science. And there were many physicians in my family, but also a couple of Ayurvedic practitioners. So there was this sort of holistic approach to health. And when I began training in psychiatry, I was very clear that I wanted to study psychiatry. I love working with people. And when I discovered, you know, psychopharmacology and realized that there were so many really devastating side effects to potentially life-saving medications, I felt that there needed to be more tools in the toolkit for individuals suffering with mental well-being. And I wanted to ask them, you know, what were you doing for exercise? How are you eating? And these were not things that we were routinely checking on in our mental health history. When I discovered the different components of how food can actually impact mental health, I really started to want to explore this more. And I think as physicians, we know there's a real gap. And some medical schools are doing better than others, but many are still lag behind in terms of helping doctors learn nutrition. So I felt that was a gap I needed to fill. I will just say that my trip to culinary school was really based on my food heroes, Julia Child. And I would watch her back in the day in Boston when I couldn't afford cable television. And she was in this amazing series called The French Chef. And it was really encouraging to be a young cook and learning food in that way. And when I discovered, you know, she's known for her culinary career, but that was her second career, I thought to myself, well, you know, if she could do it, why not me? I love food. I love nutrition. And I just want to learn more. So when I say that hindsight is 2020, I didn't expect these different components to come together in the way that they did. And I feel very fortunate that I could, you know, forge a way forward, helping people with an additional way to feel more emotionally fit.
Uma Naidu is a psychiatrist, chef, and nutritionist, and director of the Nutritional and Metabolic Psychiatry Program at Massachusetts General Hospital. Her book is called This Is Your Brain on Food. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.